Okay, thank you. So I'm going to talk about some connected issues to do with anisotropy, the trispectrum, and this kinematic dipole that we've seen. And I might touch a first time at the end of some issues related to statistical anisotropy. And so I just wanted to start by saying that if I'm talking about anisotropy, statistical anisotropy or trispectrum, these are basically the same thing. We're talking about the same phenomenon on the sky. I think this was first pointed out a long time ago by these guys. And basically, the idea is that if you've got some statistical anisotropy, there's a preferred direction. But a priori, there's no reason for that direction to be any particular direction. If you average over the direction, then it's statistically isotropic. But then it's typically non-Gaussian. So it's up to you whether you like to think of things as having fixed directions or average over them. One of them is statistical anisotropy, and one of them is non-Gaussianity. So in the case of primordial fluctuations, you might think about the largest fluctuations as being fixed, in which case they induce anisotropy, or you might average over all the large-scale fluctuations, and then you'd have non-Gaussianity. So since this is a primordial cosmology conference, I'm going to be talking emphasized starting from primordial fluctuations. So I've just written down the most, probably the simplest way of modulating what might happen in the very early universe, beginning with the hot Big Bang. So if I have some Gaussian fluctuations, eta naught, then I'm going to modulate it spatially by some other field, phi. So maybe this is related to something that happened in multi-field deflation or something. The idea is just look in Planck for phi. Is there any evidence for it? Is it things modulating? So this is us in the center here. We're looking at the last scattering surface. And it turns out that we can only really measure really large-scale modulations. So I've drawn some really large-scale modulations. Here's phi positive. Here's phi negative. And the nice thing about this is you can see the thickness of the last scattering surface is really thin compared to these large-scale blobs. So it's a very good approximation to treat this phi as being constant here. And if you do that, the impact of this modulation on the primordial fluctuations is simply to modulate the entire CMB you observe on small scales. So the CMB you'd observe in this model would be the Gaussian fluctuations you'd normally have modulated by the value of this field at the recombination surface in the direction in which you're looking. So this is exactly equivalent in this limit to just modulating the Gaussian fluctuations by some field F, which is the modulation model people have talked about before. And in principle, looking for this is extremely straightforward because all it does is it just changes the amplitude of the power spectrum in different parts of the sky. So phi here is positive, so you get more power, so the power spectrum should be bigger than over here. And by looking for that, you can see whether there's any primordial modulation going on. So the simplest example would be local non-Gaussianity, where you just say that your curvature perturbation is some Gaussian thing plus the Gaussian thing squared times FNL. And if you expand out your Gaussian thing in short modes and long modes, then you can just rewrite that as a modulated field. So what you end up with then is that the short modes being modulated by 1 plus FNL times the long modes. So this is precisely the form of that modulation model I wrote down, where phi, the modulation field, is here, just the long, large-scale curvature fluctuations. And it turns out you can then write down very simply what this is in terms of a bispectrum and trispectrum if you want to interpret things that way. Because these modes are constant through the last scattering surface, the bispectrum just measures the correlation of the modulation with the large-scale temperature. So it depends on this correlation here between the large-scale temperature and this modulating field. And the trispectrum just measures the variance of this modulation. So it depends on this modulation, the power spectrum of this modulation. And these approximations are actually quite accurate if you're looking at very large scales, as I will be. So more generally, you can look for a trispectrum, which is not coming from local non-Gaussianity of that form, but still local. So I'm just going to define tau and L of L as being the power in that modulation you're observing, divided, normalized by the power in the curvature fluctuation. So this is just a conventional definition of tau and L, which rather confuses the unit. So things to bear in mind is if you have a 10 to the minus 3 modulation, which is about the limit of what Planck can see at 1 sigma, that corresponds to tau and L of around 500. So in the simple case where you have local non-Gaussianity, your modulation field is just 6/5 FNL times the large scale curvature fluctuations. In that case, if you just substitute in, you get 6/5 FNL squared. But in general, this fluctuation field doesn't have to be correlated totally to the primordial curvature fluctuation. But maybe you've got some other contribution from some uncorrelated field, chi. In that case, this contributes to the variance, but it doesn't contribute to the cross-correlation. So the bispectrum would be the same, but tau and L ends up being bigger than 6/5 FNL squared. Then if you've got this as a function of L, you've reconstructed the modulation, you measure the power spectrum, just sum up in an optimal way over L's, and get your estimate for your best estimate of the nearly scale invariant trispectrum. So all this boils down here to just measuring this modulation you're seeing on the last scattering surface in the small scale power. So the way to do that, naively, you just work out T squared all over the sky, new Fourier transform it, and that'll tell you that mode by mode. So the optimal way to do that is you use some filtered fields. Instead of having T squared, here I've got a filtered T and another filtered T. So the filters here just optimize the signal to noise to give you more sensitivity. So this is a quadratic estimator. It just depends on T times T in some combination. You can relatively easily calculate. So the way of calculating these things is exactly the same, essentially, as the lensing pipeline. So in lensing, what you're looking at is the modulation due to large-scale convergence, magnification, and shear. Here, what you're doing is you're looking for modulations due to the actual intrinsic fluctuations being modulated by a field. But the pipeline is essentially identically the same. So you're trying to reconstruct some field. You've got some weight function. This depends on what you're actually looking at. So this is different for lensing in the case up here. But the general structure is the same. So you have two filtered fields of the observed Planck temperature. And the only complication is that, of course, the whole sky is very anisotropic because of the galactic mask, and the noise is anisotropic. So to account for that, what you want to do is subtract that. So you just average over lots of simulations of what you've got. And that's called this mean field here. So it's a quadratic combination minus the mean field. And then what you're left with should be new stuff that's telling you about anisotropy. So this is what the mean field actually looks like in practice with Planck. So 143 times 143, there are two big contributions. One is the fact that you've got this great big galactic mask here. But the other one is that the noise itself is very anisotropic, which is mostly quadrupolar around the ecliptic here, but it's also got this rather nasty structure. And the problem with Planck is we can't actually simulate this noise terribly accurately. And the problem is if you don't subtract that mean field accurately, you'll get the wrong answer. So one way to avoid that is to try to use, instead of using T and T from the same map, you use T from one map, T from another map that's uncorrelated. And if you do that, this gives you your mean field for 143 cross 217. So that just completely gets rid of this nasty noise anisotropy here, and you're just left with a mean field due to the mask. The good thing about the mask is that you put it in yourself, so you know what it is, so you can measure, you know what this is very accurately, whether you don't know what this noise is. So the results I'll show are mainly based on using these cross spectra, just like in the main power spectrum analysis, we used cross spectra. So the main complication here is this kinematic dipole signal. So this has been talked about a few times. So this has two different effects on the CMB we see in Planck maps. One is a modulation and one's an aberration. So this is from the fact that the Earth is shooting through space quite fast with respect to the CMB rest frame. So there's a big dipole. In principle, this is relatively straightforward. You just boost your CMB and you'll get another black body. And it's still simple, it's still a black body. But because of the way that Planck defines effective temperature in terms of the brightness observed, you actually end up in what you get in the Planck maps as being a frequency-dependent modulation of the fluctuation. So the fluctuations in the Planck maps have one plus this thing here dotted with the direction on the sky. So it's a dipole, but the amplitude, which is this nasty function here, depends on the frequency of the map that you're looking at. So this modulation is just increasing the power on one side of the sky compared to the other one. This is greatly magnified, where V is 0.85C. The other effect is the aberration effect. This is just standard relativistic beaming effect. So you end up with slightly smaller looking fluctuations in the direction you're moving, larger fluctuations away from the direction you're looking. And this is exactly like the dipole lensing. So the estimator for this effect is exactly the same as the lensing one, restricted to L of 1. And the good thing about this is that we know what it should be, because we know from the temperature dipole what direction we're moving in with respect to the rest frame. So this is the dipole direction up here, which I call beta parallel. I've marked on here a couple of other orthogonal directions. And we know this amplitude is about 1 times 10 to the minus 3. And then we can work out what this modulation amplitude should be at the different Planck maps that we might want to use. And what you find, in fact, is it's pretty small, 100 gigahertz, 0.2%. But as you go to higher frequencies, this boosting effect becomes larger and larger. So down here at 857, it's actually a 2% modulation of the power. So this is saying if you measure power spectrum over there and over there, you'll get quite different answers by this sort of factor. So for what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to use 143 and 217, which are the main cosmology channels, where it's about 0.24% and 0.37%. You should be aware that if you're going to use SMECA, that's an interestingly complicated mixture of all these different things modulated in these different ways. And unfortunately, as yet, we haven't actually simulated or studied in detail the effect of that on what you might expect to see in the Planck map, but beware that the Spica map is potentially rather complicated. So the first thing to do is check the signal correctly. You know it should be there, you've predicted what it should be. Can you actually see it in the maps? And the answer is yes. So here, this is the detection of what we tried to do, looking for aberration, modulation separately, and then combining them into an optimal estimator, which is on the left here. So the grey histogram is what you get if there is no kinematic effect. The lines are what you get from various data combinations, and you can see in this one here, the lines are well away from the grey histograms. So that's telling you that you've detected the dipole effect. And the red histograms are what you get from simulations of what you expect to see. And more or less, we're consistent across these different estimators of the directions of what you'd expect to see. There's a slight issue, perhaps, with some foreground contamination in this direction, but more or less it's consistent. And this here is a round of 5-sigma detection. So in the Planck map, there exists a 5-sigma anisotropic signal, which is consistent with what you'd expect, more or less. Potentially, there's some foreground issue, which is probably in 217. I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. But you should note that this is not included in lots of other things. So for example, the parameter analysis, this is not included. We can now measure Thetis star, which is its angular size of the hot and cold spots, incredibly accurately, 0.1%. So averaged over a full sky, this wouldn't matter at all. So it would average to zero, because it's a dipole. But because the mask is asymmetric on the actual estimators that we use, there is some residual effect, and we estimate that that's around 0.25 sigma on this parameter. So really, we should be accounting for this bias in this parameter. But because this is measured so much more accurately than other parameters, we expect that the residual effect should be small. But it's not accounted for in the current analysis. OK, so now we can go and look for the primordial modulations. So this is using this cross-map estimator. What do you get if you look for the reconstruction? So this is a picture here, the reconstructed power as if a function of position on the sky. And this is without subtracting those kinematic signal. And you can clearly see by eye, there's a dipole in this picture. So this is the kinematic dipole you're seeing here. So to get rid of it, you want to include in the simulations for the mean field the known signal that you should see. If you do that and subtract it out in the mean field, then you get this picture. But in an ideal world, if it was statistically isotropic and there was no modulation, this would just be consistent with noise. So to see if that's true, you can calculate the power spectrum of it. So this shows you the power spectrum of the modulation as a function of L. Purple line here is what you get without subtraction. So there's a big dipole at L of 1 here. That's the kinematic signal we expect. If we subtract that signal from the lower map, then we get this red curve here. So the dipole here is on this 1-sigma bar from simulation, so it's perfectly consistent with what you'd expect for an isotropic universe. There's a bit of a glitch, though, unfortunately, here. L of 3, octopole, looks somewhat high. So that's interesting. What I plotted here is what you'd expect from a scale invariant tau and L. And you can see that it doesn't actually look anything like the scale invariant tau and L. So there's no evidence here for a dipole. There's no evidence for something that looks like a tau and L, but there is some possible crud here. So why do I say it might be crud? Well, it seems to vary a little bit with the frequency you're looking at. So this is the cross thing with the dipole subtraction. But if you look at 143 times 143 and 217.217, you're dominated by the mess from the fact that you can't measure the noise accurately. But you can also see that this octopole here varies between these two. And in fact, here, it's lower than it was up here, despite the fact that there's lots of noise contamination in here. And so really, this is indicating that it's varying with a function of frequency. And there's probably some contamination from 217. Maybe it's some dust or something. But at the moment, we don't have a clear answer for what that signal is. So if you just naively pretend it's cosmological, you can just go and estimate tau and L, measuring the power of your modulation. And if you do that, you get 442, which is very consistent with what you get from Gaussian simulation. So there's no evidence from this frequentist estimator for any primordial modulation. So this is the histogram from simulation. This is the data points. It all looks fine. And the reason it looks fine is the optimal estimator here doesn't weight the octopole very highly because the expected signal is very low. On the other hand, if you ask the Bayesian question about given the observed data, what value of tau and L do you think we should have, then that favors much larger values. Unfortunately, the ultimate limit we get on tau and L is quite a lot weaker. And it's also weaker because there are so few modes, all the signals in L1, 2, 3. So there's a huge cosmic variance, so you end up with these very skewed distributions. There's very broad tails out here. So the fact that this is 2,800 here rather than 800 is partly because the octopole is high, but it's also partly because of the fact that 95% confidence you're always hit by these very broad tails. So we expect it to be higher than the frequentist estimate. It's unfortunately a bit higher because of this unknown signal. Okay, so I'm going to finish by briefly commenting on what this might relate to the power asymmetries people have been talking about. So this is showing that in the dipole there was nothing there apparently, so how is that consistent with the power asymmetries? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. At the moment, I'm afraid we don't have any clear answers, so I'm just going to show what happens when you restrict particular ranges of L when you're looking for these modulations. So that's very easy, you just restrict these filters here to a particular range of L's. The previous results I showed were using all the L's, so that's the optimal estimator looking for a dipole modulation. You can restrict the range, and this shows what you get going up to a particular L max. On the left here, I compared with an old paper I did with Duncan, 2009, from WMAP. So this is the amplitude of the dipole modulation here. And you can see that with WMAP, we got this going down with L max. It was down to about a percent level by 500. This dot dashed line here is what you'd expect from a perfect sky. Obviously, we did a bit worse than the perfect sky. And this shows the significance here. So there's a glitch down here, which looks quite significant, around L max of 60. So that's the well-known hemispherical power asymmetry on the large-scale modes, which everyone agrees is there in the maps. And there's possibly a lower dip here. So this is what you get from Planck. And of course, this looks very consistent on large scales because it's the same sky, so it has to modulo small changes in significance. And this, as you can see here, keeps going down. So this is with the kinematic signal subtracted now. And it seems to go down to about 0.2% down at the bottom here, which is consistent with that tau and L constraint I gave. So the tau and L constraint is using L max right at the top here, using all the information. If you restrict to larger and larger scales, what you find is that the amount of modulation that's allowed just decreases, as you'd expect, for the amount of noise. However, there are these points here and here. So this is the L. Also this one around L of 500, which looks slightly anomalous, but of course choosing to look at this point, just that point, is rather a posteriori, so it's not entirely clear what the significance of that is. The apparent significance of the smaller scales is very small here. This looks perfectly reasonable values for the significance. So the modulation from this is constrained to be less than about 0.2% at this high L range. And if you plot the directions as a function of L max, with the kinematics subtracted, you find a cluster in this direction, we know. So I think this clustering here is basically because as you add more and more L, you're still dominated by the anisotropy from L less than 500. So it does move around a little bit. It's not quite clear why it moves up there. But if you don't subtract the kinematics, then of course you see that kinematic dipole very clearly. As you go to higher L max, it moves towards the direction of the kinematic signal. So the main message here is that if you want to talk about these anisotropies, you really have to model this kinematic signal. And unfortunately, the isotropy paper currently doesn't. So it's not entirely clear whether significance is quoted there at the moment are just detections or projections of the kinematic signal or whether there's some other signal. And that's an unresolved issue that I'm not going to resolve. You can also look in bands to see whether or not all the power is aligning in the same way. And this is with kinematics subtracted. So here are the points where it points on the sky. So depending on what you think, that looks pretty random to me. If you don't subtract kinematics, then of course they're going to cluster in the direction of the dipoles. You know, on average, they're going to be pointing over here. So they all sort of shift a little bit in this direction. Yes. This is 217 cross. This is a completely different analysis from the anisotropy paper. The different estimator, I'm looking for a different thing. This is a dipole here over the full sky. It's not just patches. The filtering is different, the mask is different, the whole thing is completely different. And the dipole signal does not include the kinematic. That's something we're working on and obviously hope to have a more consistent picture at some point before too long. So this is the conclusions. There's 5 sigma effect detected in the kinematic dipole. It's there and it should be accounted for in any other analyses. If you take that out, then the large-scale modulation power seems to be nearly consistent with isotropy, but there's this annoying octopole, maybe a bit of foreground contamination. So there's issues there left to resolve that we don't know. We'll put a limit on tau and L, which is the most physically motivated model, which is perfectly consistent with no non-Gaussianity. Low L power is, of course, consistent with WMAP. It's the same sky, so it absolutely has to be. If you go to higher scales, there's no particularly strong evidence, in this analysis at least, of modulation. So this is less than 0.2% at L max of 2000 is what we're seeing there. So these kinematic effects are not included, and obviously that's the next thing to do, is to include them in all the simulations consistently wherever they're likely to matter, and try to converge on a consistent picture, which unfortunately we don't have yet. Thank you.
Yeah, if you go back a few slides to one of the ones where you were showing how the, So the, if you run a Gaussian simulation, right, how should I expect that axis to wander? I shouldn't expect it to wander very far, right, because it's, you're adding L's here, right? So at some point, some scatter will drive that axis, and then as many L's you add, it'll just wander in the neighborhood of that, right?
I think that's right. I think in most realizations, you'd expect the low L one to be subdominant, but because there's this relatively significant fluctuation at low L, that tends to dominate at rather lower L than you'd expect. But normally, you'd expect the really high L's to completely dominate L less than 1,000 after a while.
Right.
But yes, I agree with you. You don't expect them to be uncorrelated.
They're
highly correlated.
Right. So you think that picture is highly significant? Well, it depends on that.
This is not a significance of anything. This is just a picture of direction.
Yeah, but it draws
the amplitude.
Eye, right?
Amplitude, of course, is going down very rapidly.
Yeah.
So these are 0.2%.
So for a simulation, right, where you didn't have any significant or nearly significant outlier, should that wander around like this?
I think it's due to the low L's. This is the picture of just using L bigger than 1,100, exactly. And here the bands you see are scattering all over the place. So I think that previous picture is mainly dominated by L less than 500, right. And that's dominating the direction. You add more, and it just drifts a bit. Yes, yeah. Well, I thought this was going to be controversial. Point out.
All right, Dick is almost done writing his talk, so we're also it's time for one more question. Is it fair to say that the question is closed pretty much now of this?
No, the whole analysis has not been done. Vast chunks of the analysis have not been done with kinematic effect in it, so we don't know what the answer is there. So for example, these patches are looking at particular things, so maybe there's a stronger signal there than you get in a dipole. We can't rule out that.
The question is open. The significance of the high L part, okay, for the power anisotropy. I mean, this was meant to illustrate that, you know, at this level of precision, you need to include that correction that was not fully done, and so as long as this is not done, we cannot conclude. But that's a different analysis. For this analysis, this is very clear. But that's not the one that is in the isotropy and statistics paper, so before you can conclude for the other analysis, the work has to be done. But indeed, it does suggest that the significance will go down.
Sorry, but this is more physically sensible analysis, right? This is what you probably want to do.
What everybody would do from the start. This one.
Once again, there are a series of analyses. This has been done fully for this one. Bear with us for what is in the isotropy and statistics paper.
There's one more question in the back.
No?
Okay. Sorry. All right, well, let's thank Anthony one more time.